Welcome to our panel on the codes and conduct of war. And I will introduce all of our paper givers in the order that they will give their papers at once. So first we have D.H. Dilbeck, who received his doctorate from the University of Virginia. He is now an assistant professor at Oklahoma Baptist University. His paper is entitled, Common Justice and Plain Expediency, the Lieber Code's Vision of Just Warfare Against Civilians, which I assume is drawn from your recently completed dissertation. Then we will have David P. Hopkins, a doctoral candidate at Wayne State University. His paper today is entitled, Whole Families and Whole Neighborhoods Have Come, Guerrilla Warfare and the Creation of the Refugee Crisis in the Trans-Mississippi. And finally, we have Lisa Tendrick Frank, who has her doctorate from the University of Florida. She is the editor of many anthologies and encyclopedias, and her book, The Civilian War, Confederate Women and Union Soldiers During Sherman's March, is forthcoming from LSU Press in the spring of 2015, very timely in terms of the anniversary of Sherman's March, so I'm sure we'll all want to be looking for that. And her paper today is entitled, The Vindictive Nature of Our Enemy, The Eviction of Confederate Families from Atlanta. So, welcome back.
Thank you, Leanne. And I just want to echo again the thanks that have been often given to the folks at the Filson, our co-conveners, for putting this wonderful conference together. I have to confess at the outset, I feel a little grateful, relieved maybe, to be placed in this final time slot in the afternoon. It's been a very full day, a very informative day, a long day. But you all have been a really wonderful and engaged audience, but I'm under no illusions here. I won't ask for a show of hands, but I know many of you have missed your regular afternoon naps, maybe. Or some brilliant thing was said earlier and it's still rattling around in your head, your mind's distracted. And that's liberating for us, these final panelists here. All of our absurd and wrong-headed claims will maybe hopefully go somewhat unnoticed or unheard even. We can leave with our reputations intact or something like that. I don't know. Let me just be sort of completely upfront, frank at the outset about what I'm going to try to do, what I'm doing in this paper. We've heard a lot about history of guerrilla warfare. I'm not really going to be saying anything about that. We've heard a lot that might be classified as sort of conventional military history, and I'm not going to be really talking about that either to a large degree. What I am doing, though, is something I like to think of in a way as a kind of moral history. And what I mean by that is just simply things that fascinate me about the Civil War, the sort of things I want to talk about here in a moment, are, in the broadest sense, how Civil War Americans living through the war, come to terms with, grapple with, answer all the big, thorny, complicated moral problems, dilemmas that the war itself raises, especially questions about how the war itself ought to be prosecuted. And that's really, in the broadest terms, the focus of my talk today. I want to begin with a few questions that I think we living in 2014 still live with to a large degree, but questions that Civil War Americans themselves had to come to terms with, and I hope we can come alongside them and think about them in the way that they thought about them. So, is it possible to wage a just war that directly targets a civilian population? Put it another way, do warring nations have a moral obligation to contain only to the battlefield all the horrors, hardships of warfare? Or can a nation justly, directly, unleash all the terrors of the hard hand of war against non-combatants? For that matter, what exactly even would a just war against civilians actually look like in practice? Well, those moral questions, I think, demanded attention from Union political and military leaders whose armies, after all, often found themselves in close contact with Southern civilians. And historians have written a lot on that topic. We've heard a lot about it today on that topic. That's undoubtedly one we could consider from a lot of angles. But what I want to focus on in my talk is on what one man, Francis Lieber, had to say about all of this. I'll focus in particular on a document that we often refer to now as the Lieber Code, issued, Leanne talked to us a bit about it last night, issued in April of 1863 as General Orders number 100, given the title at that time as Instructions for the Government of Armies of the United States in the Field. Those of you that aren't familiar with the Lieber Code, at its simplest was a list of 157 articles, rules, you might say, that were distilled from the laws of war that were meant to offer kind of guidelines to Union armies. If this is what sort of a just war looked like in practice, the laws of war being that a body of legal thought, ideas concerning conduct in war, right conduct in war at its simplest. The Lieber Code is meant to distill that complex body of legal thought to succinct, usable guidelines for hard-pressed Union officers especially. So that's my focus, the Lieber Code. And the question I want to ask an answer hopefully today is just simply this. What did Lieber's code, as it became known, have to say about what exactly constituted, made up a just war against civilians? What did it have to say that a just war against civilians looked like? And I'm not here to suggest that all Union soldiers at all times strictly abided by Lieber's code from April of 1863 onwards, but this code, without question, was the most thorough authorized blueprint to just warfare that was handed down by Union officials during the Civil War. And in it, Lieber, its principal author, articulated what I think were a few widely shared ideas about how a war that deliberately targeted civilians could still be a just war. Lieber's code, in short, among other things, offers a influential, revealing set of guidelines to navigating one of the more perplexing moral questions waged by the Civil War, simply what constituted a just treatment of civilians, especially enemy civilians. So in a moment, I'll discuss at length the Code's particular articles on the treatment of civilians. But first, let me make a sort of general introductory statement, argument, about the Lieber Code's vision of just warfare against civilians, as I put it in my subtitle. I do think that the Code's articles conformed to a particular vision, set of ideas about just warfare and just warfare against civilians. And in general terms, by way of a sort of introduction, that vision was this, to quote the Code here, "The more vigorously wars are pursued, the better it is for humanity." I'm going to say that again because it's central to all I'm going to say later. The more vigorously wars are pursued, the better it is for humanity. What Lieber and the Code is saying here, in effect, by appealing to a vigorous war, is that the most humane, the most moral military efforts deployed all possible means to achieve victory as swiftly as possible, albeit within certain inviolable restraints. I'll get to those in a moment. Nothing about a vigorous war in Lieber's mind necessarily demanded that Union armies leave civilians utterly undisturbed. However, the code also sought, I'll get to this in a moment, to temper violence towards civilians in certain important ways. But before I say more on this vision of just warfare against civilians, let me say a quick word on who Francis Lieber was and why he came to draft this code that bears his name. Lieber, as some of you may know, was a German-American jurist. He was born in Berlin, probably in 1798, and from his earliest childhood days, he was captivated by war. It shaped so many of his formative experiences as a child and eventually engrossed his intellectual interests as a scholar. After a brief stint as a soldier, he settled on the life of a scholar. He lived briefly in London, hobnobbed with J.S. Mill, Jeremy Bentham, and others, finally made his way to America, ran a gymnasium in Boston for a time, co-published the wildly successful Encyclopedia Americana, and after he failed to receive his much-desired appointment at Harvard. So all you academics here can sympathize with Lieber. He had the dream job, but he didn't get it. After he didn't get it, he moved south to Columbia, South Carolina, taught 20 years there, roughly 20 years at history, political economy at South Carolina College. Remained there until the late 1850s, but eventually moved back to New York City. Took up a post at Columbia College. As Civil War loomed, then erupted, Lieber, despite his time in South Carolina, remained unshakably loyal to the Union, even though one of his three sons would eventually fight and then die for the Confederacy. It very much was a family torn. Another son was wounded at Fort Donelson fighting for the Union. All that said, not long after war began, Lieber worried that Federals and Confederates suffered from what he called a terrible confusion of ideas about the laws of war, a confusion that he worried dangerously corrupted how they were prosecuting this war. He lamented, in particular, prevailing ideas and actions about guerrilla warfare, prisoner exchanges, the parole. And as a result of that, Lieber pestered the Lincoln administration, key members of the Union military leadership, to see to it that some sort of user-friendly code of conduct, a guide to the laws of war, was produced and distributed to Union forces. And finally, with the blessing of Henry Halleck, Edward Stanton, Lieber got his wish. And not only that, for all his pestering, he was also tasked with more or less writing the first draft of this code. And he worked on this primarily in the wake of the Union's terrible, demoralizing defeat at Fredericksburg in late 1862. There was a bit of tinkering by a committee, and the code was issued in April of 1863. As I've said already, these 157 articles that made up the code were meant to offer, and did offer, I think, a succinct, a usable, quite thorough guide to the laws and usages of war, as the code itself puts it. It's a guide, to put it another way, to upholding morality in warfare. After all, as the code proclaims early in one article, I'm quoting it here, "Men who take up arms against one another in public war do not cease on this account to be moral beings, responsible to one another and to God." The code's articles explained what exactly were the moral responsibilities incumbent upon these moral beings at war. In doing so, the content of the articles ranged widely from martial law to retaliation to treatment of prisoners of war, to treatment of private property, spies, flags of truce, irregular warfare, armistice, capitulation, among many other topics. But to my topic, what did the Lieber Code have to say about the treatment of enemy non-combatants? Now, to understand this dimension of the code, it's necessary to return again to one of the code's most important and revealing articles, in some way its thesis statement. As I've quoted already, "The more vigorously wars are pursued, the better it is for humanity. Sharp wars are brief." And this idea, this article, I think shaped nearly everything else that's in the code, what it proclaimed about the nature of just warfare. The more vigorously wars are pursued, the better it is for humanity. Sharp wars are brief. What Lieber code says here, in effect, was that the surest way to limit the total suffering, the total destruction occasioned by this war, is to end it as quickly as possible. And the surest way to end the war as quickly as possible was to wage it vigorously, as the code puts it. As Lieber explained on another occasion, when it came to war, quote, "The shorter it is, the better, and the intenser it is carried on, the shorter it will be." Lieber's code was meant, in large measure, to explain just what a vigorously waged war or an intenser war looked like in its prosecution. Let me be clear here before I go further. Lieber did believe, it's laid forth in the code, that certain actions were always illegitimate, immoral, we might say, always ought to be forbidden in war. The moral demands of a vigorously waged war didn't justify everything. But Lieber and his code were caught in a kind of grim tension on this point. The code tried to reconcile a commitment to vigorously waged wars with a commitment to certain inviolable restraints in war, certain restraints that were never to be done away with. One article of the code proclaimed, "To save the country is paramount to all other considerations." But it's a remarkable claim, a sweeping one. But how exactly, really, does that idea, to save the country is paramount to all other considerations, fit with another idea, another article from the code I've already quoted. Men who take up arms in a public war don't cease on this account to be moral beings, responsible to one another and to God. To put it more bluntly, which exactly is the greater good? To save the country or to abide by one's moral obligations? And this is a tension that runs throughout Lieber's code and is particularly evident in its articles on the treatment of civilians. So let me turn to these particular articles. Early on, the code proclaims the unarmed citizen is to be spared in person, property, and honor as much as the exigencies of war will admit. A justly waged war, in short, endeavors as much as possible to spare civilians from the hardships war unleashed, even as it recognized that civilians would never be spared completely. A just war was not unashamedly total, in that it indiscriminately, zealously targeted civilians without restraint. The whole purpose of Lieber's code, in fact, was to present exactly that sort of utter disregard of the moral obligations incumbent upon warring armies. As such, Lieber's code explicitly listed certain actions that federal soldiers were to never commit against enemy civilians. These included, quote, wanton violence, all destruction of property not commanded by authorized officers, all robbery, all pillage or sacking, all rape, wounding, maiming, or killing of such inhabitants. Now, as you probably noted, nothing in that article forbade the destruction of civilian property necessarily, only the destruction of property not commanded by the authorized officer. However, the article did contain quite a few sweeping condemnations of physical violence against civilians themselves, explicitly prohibited rape, wounding, maiming, or killing. And Lieber in the code didn't dwell at length on the proper punishment for soldiers who violated that article, but he did suggest in an article that an immediate execution of soldiers guilty of violating that article might be permissible in some circumstances, as he put it, that it may be lawful for such a soldier to be killed on the spot by a superior. Still, with that said, those restrictions, Lieber's code also explicitly sanctioned what we might call a spirit of directed severity. Disloyal civilians could, in fact, should fare far worse at the hands of Union armies than loyal civilians would, loyal Southern civilians. The burden of war, to quote the code, should fall harder upon the heads of disloyal civilians, the code said, though Lieber left somewhat vague in the code as to what exactly he had in mind when he used that phrase, the burden of war. Still, the code declared that the, quote, manifestly loyal citizens ought to be protected against the hardships of war as much as the common misfortune of all war admits. To put it simply, Union armies were not to wage a reckless war against all Southern civilians. Not all Southerners deserved the same fate, Southern civilians. And for that matter, there were limits to what federal armies could legitimately do to disloyal civilians. Lieber's attempt, though, to shield at least some civilians came always with an important disclaimer, as I've quoted already, as much as the exigencies of war will admit. Yes, Lieber said, soldiers should never resort to certain actions against civilians, so wanton violence, pillage, rape, maiming. But Lieber also assumed that, as he put it, the overruling demands of a vigorous war, military necessity, to put it another way, would sometimes compel armies to subject civilians to great hardship and suffering. For example, while the Union ought to, quote, acknowledge and protect private property, the code said, its armies could also seize it, quote, by way of military necessity for the support or other benefit of the army. Lieber's justification of subjecting civilians to war's hardships rested upon his larger vision of a moral war, which I've hinted at already. The harsh treatment of civilians was sometimes necessary in a vigorously prosecuted war, but only if it worked towards ending the war as quickly as possible, which, after all, was the most moral, humane thing a belligerent could do, in the war as quickly as possible. To induce civilian suffering in war was never desirable, Lieber believed, but it might be a harrowing path to the most moral of wars, stern and short above all. And this, in the end, I think, is the heart of the Lieber Code's moral vision of just warfare against civilians, The more vigorously wars are pursued, the better it is for humanity, albeit only if warring parties recognize the necessary limits, restraints, even in vigorously waged wars. Still, I'll say again, the code also proclaimed that to save the country is paramount to all other considerations, which in the hands of zealous military commanders might well prove a sort of blank check justifying anything. It's for that reason that Mark Grimsley, among others, concluded in his words that the code was, quote, ambiguous. The line between wanton destruction and vigorous prosecution was hazy at best. Perhaps that line was, at times, hazy in the code, but I think that might be taking it a bit too far, because at its heart, the Liber Code was not really all that ambiguous. That is to say, it clearly set forth a comprehensive moral vision of what a justly waged war looked like against soldiers and civilians alike. The Code's moral vision was often a grim one. It did potentially justify terrifying, though never limitless, violence towards non-combatants. And yet, still, the Code's articles conform to Liber's fierce convictions about the true nature of the most moral, even humane wars. To quote Liber again, sharp wars are brief. And we can imagine him adding, brief wars are moral wars. In conclusion, I'll just say this. Civil War Americans like Liber lived at the cusp of a modern world in which the hopes of many war was going to continue and endure. And he responded by embracing a particular vision of just warfare that he believed, that he hoped, would limit, in the end, the total suffering and destruction that the Union's war unleashed, especially against civilians. Liber hoped that federal armies abiding by his code would best fulfill their moral obligations to God and humanity as moral beings engaged in war. Thank you very much.
All right. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. I thank you to the Filson Historical Society for inviting me and being able to listen to so many great papers. This project deals with refugees in the Trans-Mississippi, or this paper does, excuse me, and it's part of a larger project, my dissertation. Before I dive into it, I do want to talk briefly about the use of the word refugee. I'm still fighting if I want to continue to use that word. I know the Army uses that word. The Union Army, the Confederate Army, so does the Freedmen's Bureau, and sometimes the refugees themselves. But I think a more accurate description of these people would be displaced persons or uprooted citizens. I think sometimes refugee, at least the way the more wealthy refugees use the term, implies they have a choice. They have somewhere else to go, where a displaced person does not. They're just left to sort of wander the countryside. So please keep that in mind. The wartime displacement of people in Arkansas and Missouri was not a single simultaneous act, but many. Some families fled their homes and communities at the very start of the war, while others were able, for a variety of reasons and factors, to wait out much of the war before displacement affected them. The large number of displaced people in the region came out of a variety of factors, some unique to the West, some not. This included intense guerrilla warfare that wreaked havoc on local populations, causing many of these people to flee their homes. In addition, divided allegiances existed among communities throughout the border states and the Upper South, and these were especially acute in Missouri and Arkansas. Factors common to war like food shortages, clashes between the armies, and the inability to secure their family's safety sent many to seek refuge. The clashes between the regular armies did not always play by the rules of conventional warfare, as this conference indicates, and you have unconventional army policies and the irregular warfare in the region that are the most prominent examples of this. Union General Thomas Ewing's order that evacuated a swath of Missouri's western border complicated the already growing refugee crisis in western Missouri, as did military clashes at Wilson's Creek, Pea Ridge, Prairie Grove, and other battles throughout the western theater. So this paper is going to examine the creation of the refugee crisis in that region as a result of both guerrilla warfare and the Union Army's response to that warfare in the Trans-Mississippi West. While one might generally assume that those who sympathize with the Union made their way north, while uprooted persons who cast their lots with the Confederacy made their way south, people's experiences weren't always that clear-cut. People fled to places where they felt protected. Unionists, many displaced because of the Union defeat at Wilson's Creek in August of 1861, fell back with the Army to Rolla, Missouri, and then eventually to St. Louis, where it was an important location of activity regarding displaced people in Missouri, because in St. Louis they could get hospital care, and it was also the location of the Western Sanitary Commission, which helped a lot of these people. And according to the Western Sanitary Commission, in one of their reports detailing the initial flood of people to the city after Wilson's Creek stated, quote, "This military post, Rolla, has been a city of refuge for many refugees from southwest Missouri. An average of 300 persons have been sheltered and rationed here by the government all the time. And thousands have reached this post and passed on to St. Louis to scatter themselves through the free states and the West," end quote. Rolla was the epicenter of the displacement crisis during the first 2 years of the war. The large numbers of people who massed here created a logistical problem for the Army, as they had to find a way to feed and clothe this large and ever-increasing group of people. The mass of people at Rolla would be one of the first large encounters between displaced people and the Army. This small central Missouri community would also be the starting point on how civilians and military officials would treat displaced people. By 1860, the rail line west from St. Louis was finished only as far as Phelps County, and while it served as the end of the line in the railroad sense, it was the beginning of the end for many displaced people's journey northward. Here was the potential for transportation further north, where these people could receive aid and supplies. And so you have the stories of those who arrived at Rolla from various points in Missouri, as well as north central and northwestern Arkansas. You'd hear these stories, and they were certainly very extraordinary. One undated account that involved an unnamed blind woman at Rolla detailed her husband's murder at the hands of guerrillas early in the war. This woman, quote, "and her poor family of six children who had walked all the way from Arkansas to Rolla, Missouri, her little children leading her several miles by the hand." And there were others with similar stories who made their way from points across Arkansas and southwestern Missouri to escape these murderous guerrilla bands in search of aid and protection, again, ultimately making their way to St. Louis. There is little doubt that this woman and her family made their way here for this reason. The problem at Rolla intensified with other military engagements, forced more and more people to mass here. Eventually, the Union Army would transport many of these people in central Missouri, again, further east to St. Louis, where they could receive aid. With hostilities at Wilson's Creek, St. Louis would continue to see an increasing number of displaced people approach the city limits, and few cities played such a vital role as one of the primary hubs, again, with the Western Sanitary Commission, who worked with the Ladies Union Aid Society of St. Louis. And people came, again, from Missouri, from Arkansas, and sometimes even as far away as Texas. Usually Unionists who just wanted to get out of Texas usually came by train, sometimes on foot, other times by wagons. They often arrived here very ill, sometimes injured, suffering from the effects of starvation, dehydration, or just simple exposure to the elements. According to an 1864 report by the Western Sanitary Commission, and the Western Sanitary Commission had, you know, by 1863, 64, 65, more and more detailed reports of this refugee crisis. They talked about refugees, quote, "consisting almost entirely of helpless women and children, widows, orphans, and half-orphans, often sick or debilitated by disease, poorly clad and barefooted, with few bundles of bedding on arriving here, having no friends to go to." In St. Louis, these aid societies would give people money, food, and various other forms of assistance, like locating lost family members or transportation to destinations further north. Now, the first 2 years of the war, you have guerrilla fighters terrorizing citizens throughout the Trans-Mississippi West. And to put it simply, as you've heard at this conference, guerrilla warfare in the region was unpredictable and brutal. The actions by bushwhackers and jayhawkers were instrumental in sending people on the run in this region. For many people, guerrilla bands could be the deciding factor sending their family on the run. For many communities in Missouri and Arkansas, they were often unable to determine for whom the guerrillas fought, the Union, the Confederacy, or themselves. External appearances of these guerrilla groups meant nothing. Guerrilla fighters changed appearances, often to conceal their identity as well as their next move. Bushwhackers with long, scraggly hair, beards, specially made shirts covered with usually blue Union cavalry coats, operated the border between Missouri and Kansas, as well as the southwestern border between Arkansas and Missouri. And this, of course, is detailed in Joseph Beeline's chapter in Bleeding Kansas, Bleeding Missouri. Jayhawkers looked much the same and operated in many of the same areas. Their methods and reasons for resorting to guerrilla warfare varied almost as much as their physical appearance. These men attacked communities to elicit support for their cause, take food and supplies for their campaigns, or recruit men for service either in their guerrilla bands or in the Confederate Army. Guerrilla activity put many citizens in a position where they had to decide, sometimes rather quickly, if they were going to leave, and if they made that decision, where would they stay for the future? Describing a loved one who left an account of approaching irregulars near their home in Laclede County in south central Missouri, Elizabeth Lizzie Gilmore detailed the experience of a civilian encounter with these guerrillas in December 1864. She noted that these bushwhackers, quote, were in 1 mile of us the night he stayed at home, and they robbed Sister Helen's house that night, took two fine mares, $350, about $25 worth out of the house of Sister, was at our house to see Mr. Gilmore. Mr. Pridgen was at Lebanon with the train. Sorry, they don't use punctuation, so I'm trying to put it in on the fly. So you see, there was no person but the children at home, and the cruel demons threatening to shoot the children's brains out. Threats of property destruction, theft, and murder were made very real by these men and often left citizens no choice but to flee their homes and their communities if they hoped to survive. In so many instances, families chose to flee out of fear of the unknown as it related to guerrilla activity in the hopes that it would spare their property and, most importantly, their lives. In some instances, displaced people settled old scores with neighbors through guerrilla activity by actually taking part. Divided loyalties made for a very tense situation for the many people who lived there. Confederate sympathizers held prejudice against local Unionists and vice versa when the war began. As it continued, these tensions increased, creating what might be termed mini-civil wars in various borderland communities in Arkansas and Missouri. For example, Elvira Weir Scott, who was a Southern sympathizer living in north central Missouri, recorded the impact of Jayhawkers operating near her home in March of 1862. She said, quote, "Generally they have a malicious, envious feeling toward their neighbors who by honest industry have surrounded themselves by the comforts of life. They openly boast that they will have possession of their fine farms and think that the time has arrived for them to take time to better their fortunes. Such are 9/10 of the Union refugees. We know some of them from the East in this country. They owned nothing, were in debt, and had lived off the community as long as they could. They left of their own free will and became Union refugees. Now they are creating sympathy by their support of the free states, or they are jayhawking in other counties of the state." Displaced people actively taking part in these guerrilla activities demonstrates just how fragile North-South relations were throughout the different communities that dotted the region. Guerrilla activity provided an opportunity for those seeking some kind of revenge against Confederate sympathizers in their communities. Now, while Americans in New York or Washington, D.C. crowded around newspapers that detailed the Confederate shelling of Fort Sumter, guerrilla warfare had already gripped many Western communities and sent many residents on the run. Historian Christopher Phillips nicely details a general trajectory of guerrilla violence that would plague the region. Phillips argued that not only did guerrilla attacks on civilians grow with each year of the war, but they escalated following the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation. Part of this, Phillips argues, was because these irregular fighters sought to unleash, quote, collective retribution on the West, in part to preserve slavery and terrorize those who sought and fought to end the peculiar institution, end quote. In Arkansas, you see a very similar pattern. There was an increased intensity of guerrilla attacks corresponding with the increased Union presence in the state, which coincidentally was 1863. So in a review of Union provost marshal papers and Missouri files, Phillips goes and he searches the word guerrilla, guerrillas, bushwhackers, all the key terms. And he found that after 1863, these increased by 61%. In 1863, 75% of guerrilla-related activities occurred in the spring immediately following the proclamation, representing, quote, a clear extension of emancipation-related violence, end quote. Guerrilla violence in both Missouri and Arkansas plagued citizens there, creating a very fluid crisis in that there was no set or well-defined period in which individuals fled during the war. However, based on Phillips' evidence, more people left their homes because of guerrilla attacks during the war's later years. Now, the constant presence of guerrilla fighters in the Trans-Mississippi region, it brought about some rather unconventional military decisions that often triggered or further intensified the crisis. None was more unconventional than Union General Thomas Ewing Jr.'s General Orders No. 11. Ewing, who was a lawyer and a judge from Ohio, he had no previous military experience, but he was determined to make a name for himself during the war. So in an effort to deal with these irregular forces in Missouri, especially western Missouri, Union military officials like Ewing sought alternative solutions to the problems in their region. General Orders No. 11, issued on August 25, 1863, removed all but a handful of citizens, probably around 20%, from the counties of Bates, Cass, Jackson, and part of Vernon County in western Missouri. Inhabitants had 1 week to vacate their homes in the affected area. If residents could prove their loyalty to local Union officials, they would be relocated within the district. Otherwise, they had to leave. That simple. This was done because these four counties had some of the most intense guerrilla warfare. It was also part retaliation for Quantrill's raid on Lawrence just a few days before. And so Ewing's thinking behind this order was that guerrillas lived off citizens and found both sympathetic and vulnerable people in western Missouri. Sympathetic residents furnished guerrillas with food, shelter, and information they needed for their campaigns. And so guerrilla violence in western Missouri, notes historian Don Bowen, quote, concentrated on the western border of the state in Jackson County and proved to be the longest lasting, the most costly, and virtually impossible for the Union occupation forces to contain, end quote. As a result, citizens had to evacuate because of Ewing's order within 15 days. Now, he issued this unpopular order as a means of curtailing the activities of guerrilla fighters, especially, again, William Clark Quantrill, who had just sacked Lawrence only 4 days before. A witness to the attack in Lawrence, the former publisher of the Kansas Free State newspaper, R.G. Elliott, recounted to his sister a few days later that, quote, some were murdered in their beds, others after they had given up, and they all had surrendered themselves as prisoners were shot down in cold blood. Every man who was seen on the streets was pursued and shot. Even prisoners that were wounded and saved by some of the more human were butchered by others while under guard, end quote. While General Orders No. 11 created many enemies for the Union Army, militarily, it can be argued it achieved its goal. Following Ewing's order, much of the guerrilla activity there declined, and there are historians like Charles Mink who questions the order's effectiveness and its necessity, but I think one thing is certain, that this order created a large number of displaced people along the Missouri-Kansas border with an estimated displacement of about 20,000 Missourians. Now, despite the order's controversy, President Lincoln only cautiously approved the order. If the president felt that a military order or action might jeopardize the government's standing, especially in a border state, he would have no problem rescinding the order. This example had already been set with General Fremont in his emancipation order early in the war. And Lincoln also forced Halleck to pull back on his assessment program in 1862 and 1863. Just as an aside, this assessment program, which took place in 1862, 1863, levied taxes on disloyal citizens to help cover the costs to pay for many of these refugees. So the president didn't immediately comment on Ewing's order, but he did share his feelings with the General John Schofield a month later, stating, quote, "With the matter of removing the inhabitants of certain counties en masse and of removing certain individuals from time to time who are supposed to be mischievous, I am not now interfering, but am leaving to your own discretion." So the president's confidence in his Western generals allowed his order to remain in place. Now, the aftermath of the order is one of great destruction. The St. Louis Daily Missouri Republican noted this in an 1863 article. Our border counties south of the Missouri River suffered incalculable, not only much directly, but even more indirectly from the operations of the bandits. Our authorities, when Curtis was in power, identified the whole people with them, and by a monstrous and dreadful assumption made the whole people liable for the outrages which, disarmed as they had been, they were utterly powerless to prevent or punish. We have seen the deplorable consequences at the sight of which Christian or civilized world may well, end quote. Union troops destroyed crops, they drove off or slaughtered livestock, making the four countries uninhabitable for the remainder of the war. Furthermore, the troops enforcing the order and subsequent evacuation failed to differentiate often between loyal and disloyal persons when disloyal property. Confederate troops like Surgeon William McFeeters detailed the destruction in simpler terms during Price's raid. He said, quote, "For several days we have been traveling through the border counties of Missouri, Jackson, Bates, and Cass. Every house has been burned and the whole country devastated by Yankees." This was more than a year after Ewing had issued the order, evidence of the total destruction by the Federals. So in conclusion, a large number of displaced people in the Trans-Mississippi West came about as the result of a variety of factors. Factors military, factors humanitarian, and of course, factors political. While these individual factors were each very different, the one thing that they all had in common was that individuals had no control over these factors, and as a result, they were forced to flee. Raids by guerrilla forces throughout the region happened often and without very little warning, both striking panic into the civilian populations and sending many of these people on the run. The destruction of all or parts of the communities in this region left many civilians with no choice but to seek refuge. In addition to this guerrilla warfare, they wanted to avoid physical destruction from the many clashes, not only from the guerrillas, but also clashes between the armies. And so this was a key factor in sending them on the run. The presence of these armies and guerrilla fighters often tested the loyalties of these displaced people and also played a role in their decision to flee. Destruction of crops and mills by these combatants left many people hungry and sent them in search of food and safety, and often into the arms of the Union Army or the Western Sanitary Commission. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you all for coming, and thank you to the Filson and to Leanne and Aaron for putting together this program. As the white women of Atlanta fled their homes in September 1864, local leaders cried foul. William Tecumseh Sherman, they proclaimed, had violated both the unstated and stated rules of war when he evicted Confederate civilians from their homes and turned them into refugees. Sherman hardly shied away from these allegations, and instead proudly proclaimed them to be the hollow protests of a weakened enemy. In the process, he revealed one of the ways that the Civil War was, in Leanne White's words, a crisis in gender. Quote, "These fellows," Sherman wrote in a letter, quote, "have a way of leaving us to take care of their families. But when I took Atlanta, I ordered them all to quit, and a big howl is raised against my barbarity. Sherman the brute. This is somewhat on the order of the school bully, who, if he can't whip you, can call you hard names or make mouths as you listen," end quote. Sherman, in this brief explanation, rejected the premise that he had an obligation to protect and care for the Confederate civilians in his midst. They were a hostile enemy, not his domestic dependents, and those who complained had only themselves to blame for abandoning their own responsibilities. As he asserted, quote, "The only way the people of Atlanta can hope once more to live in peace and quiet at home is to stop the war, which can only be done by admitting that it began in error and is perpetuated in pride." In this debate over the treatment of civilians, Sherman and his Confederate detractors agreed on very little. On one issue, however, they concurred. Female civilians were the responsibility of men, and therefore invasions and occupations of home fronts necessarily created dilemmas for the soldiers involved. For Sherman, the policy of removal resolved the crisis by physically ending the need to provide for the white women of the South. For Confederate leaders, Sherman's policy demonstrated his negligence and his disregard for his paternal obligations. For Sherman, the treasonous behavior of women made them subject to the hard hand of war. For Confederate detractors, the sanctity of womanhood should have shielded them from such abuse. On several occasions, the Union forcibly removed Confederate women and children from their homes and otherwise emptied entire towns of the civilians. Sherman's actions in Atlanta may be the most memorable, but similar large-scale evictions took place in Roswell, Georgia, and more dramatically, in four counties in Missouri, which we've heard of today. Although all of these instances resulted in the forced removal of civilians from their homes, historians have often described these actions as evacuations. Treating them as evacuations, however, has implicitly led scholars to understand this tactic as something done on behalf of the civilians, rather than something done to them, as attempts to shield women and families from the war, rather than as actions that brought war's hard hand down on them. Furthermore, this terminology draws attention away from the intended benefits that evictions provided the Union Army, and instead focuses upon the unintended or unfortunate consequences of war. The removal of families was not a benevolent act to keep women out of the line of fire. The Union Army coercively expelled women from their homes because doing so allowed it to make a quick and largely overlooked military strike at its female enemies without waging a sustained war against them. It also absolved Union men of their responsibility to care for enemy women during the ensuing occupation. The eviction of female civilians both resolved and revealed an aspect of the Civil War's crisis in gender. On one hand, Sherman and other Union officials paternalistically recognized that the rules of war and of 19th century propriety required them to adhere to various restraints when it came to the treatment of women and civilians. On the other hand, Sherman and other Union officers acknowledged that elite white women were not a passive enemy on the sidelines. They acknowledged that these women served as the backbone of Confederate morale and nationalism and provided much-needed resources and labor for the Confederate war effort. In addition, and perhaps most importantly, Confederate women could undermine the occupying Union force by waging feminine forms of guerrilla warfare or by engaging in other less aggressive but still menacing gendered ways. Evictions allowed Union officers to follow their mandate to protect and provide for families in their midst while absolving them of a sense of responsibility for those who were not under their control. Even the process of evictions, a military tactic conducted against women, could be justified by Lieber's Code, which proclaimed that, and this will now sound familiar to you, the more vigorously wars are pursued, the better it is for humanity. And which recommended that commanders, quote, throw the burden of war as much as lies within his power on the disloyal citizens. In this context, Sherman insisted that Confederate women could not be shielded from the harm that unavoidably would occur through eviction or occupation. It would be impossible to shield them entirely from these adversities. Quote, you might as well appeal against the thunderstorm as against these terrible hardships of war. They are inevitable. By 1864, Sherman understood many of the complications that occurred when armies met civilians. These complications held true whether those civilians were male or female. As a 19th century student of war, Sherman recognized this reality long before the Atlanta campaign. He had learned from his experiences in Florida's Seminole Wars, as well as those during the Civil War that women, that women and civilians were just as much the enemy as were soldiers. He knew that to defeat an army, he must defeat the soldier support systems. Furthermore, guerrilla warfare made it difficult to discern between combatant and non-combatant, and to create military policies that affected one, but not the other. Sherman had learned the lesson early on and used it in response to protests over his actions in Mississippi in 1863, when he asserted, quote, "We are justified in treating all the inhabitants as combatants," end quote. He refused to be swayed by requests for leniency or help because, quote, "Of necessity in war, the commander may take your house, your fields, your everything, and turn you all out, helpless to starve. It may be wrong, but that don't alter the case. In war, you can't help yourselves, and the only possible remedy is to stop war," end quote. In this context, and with this mindset, Sherman's forces captured Atlanta on September 2, 1864. When Confederate troops fled the railroad city, more than 1,000 civilians, Southern women, children, and mostly elderly men, remained in their homes. They were not soldiers, but Sherman and others feared that they would resist and would cause problems for the army. In any case, the presence of hostile Confederate civilians would make Atlanta less than hospitable for the occupying force. As a result, on September 8, 1864, Sherman issued Special Field Order 67, which ordered the eviction of all civilians from Atlanta. The general insisted that families had no place in Atlanta now that it had become a Union command post. In addition, he refused to feed, clothe, shelter, or otherwise support this hostile, independent, feminine population. Sherman turned the citizens of Atlanta into refugees. Almost immediately after issuing Special Field Order 67, Sherman made his paternalistic logic clear to Confederate authorities. In response to Confederate John Bell Hood's outrage, Sherman insisted that the eviction was charitably done on behalf of the women. Quote, "God will judge us in due time, and he will pronounce whether it be more humane to fight with a town full of women and their families of a brave people at our back, or to remove them in time to places of safety among their own friends and people," end quote. In this response, Sherman explained that the eviction ensured the safety of these helpless female civilians, as he cast himself in the role of protector. Furthermore, he asserted, quote, "It is a kindness to these families of Atlanta," end quote, because his order would, quote, "remove them first from scenes that women and children should not be exposed to." In addition, Sherman criticized Confederates for thinking that civilians should remain in Atlanta. Throwing their characterizations of him back at them, he continued that the, quote, "brave people," and this was the Confederates who had called themselves such, quote, "should scorn to commit their wives and children to the rude barbarians who thus, as you say, violate the laws of war, as illustrated in the pages of its dark history," end quote. Confederate leaders rejected Sherman's explanation of the order, even as they embraced the paternalistic logic that shaped it. For example, Atlanta's mayor and two councilmen, quote, petitioned Sherman to reconsider the order requiring civilians to leave Atlanta, end quote. As they urged him to rethink his actions, they cast Sherman's treatment of women and children as unmanly. They appealed to his masculine obligations. Quote, "You know the woe. The horrors and the suffering cannot be described by words," end quote. The Atlanta politicians also stressed the blamelessness of female Confederates. Quote, "What has this helpless people done that they should be driven from their homes to wander strangers and outcasts and exiles," end quote. This response, which has been dutifully repeated by many Southerners and scholars since its publication, confirms the mythology that helpless women needed to be spared from the horrors of an occupying force. Sherman used his public response to these complaints to further bolster the illusion that the evacuation was a benevolent act that sheltered Confederate civilians from the horrors of war. "After all," he told the city officials, quote, "the use of Atlanta for warlike purposes is inconsistent with its character as a home for families. There will be no manufactures, commerce, or agriculture here for the maintenance of families, and sooner or later, want will compel the inhabitants to go," end quote. Sherman posited that his solution provided these families with a way to leave before they ran out of food and other necessities. Women would not be able to fend for themselves in the militarized town, and this evacuation would therefore limit female suffering. Sherman even insisted that kicking families out of their homes without much time to prepare would be done with charity. Quote, "I assert that our military plans make it necessary for the inhabitants to go away, and I can only renew my offer of services to make their exodus in any direction as easy and comfortable as possible. He publicly stressed his generosity by pointing out that he was offering transportation out of Atlanta before life in the city became even more difficult for families. Privately and sometimes publicly, however, Sherman and other union leaders acknowledged that the eviction of Confederate noncombatants served Union war aims. In particular, it was a way to prevent secessionist women from harassing soldiers and interfering in military operations. He did not want female Confederates waging gendered war on his troops, as women in occupied New Orleans had done to Benjamin Butler's. Evictions would deny any possibility of chamber pots being dumped on Union soldiers or of women otherwise treating them disrespectfully. As Sherman told Halleck, quote, "I wanted a pure Gibraltar, and we'll have it so by the 1st of October," end quote. In comparing Atlanta to an isolated military post and a key base of the British Royal Navy during the Crimean War, Sherman demonstrated his true aim. He wanted a base that had no interference from civilians who had, as he put it later, a vindictive nature. In his letters to his wife, Sherman repeatedly stressed his desire to maintain the distinction between the work of war and the feminine distractions of domestic life. He alerted Ellen Sherman to both the military and personal reasons for evicting enemy civilians from the city. Not only did he, quote, take the ground that Atlanta is a conquered place that he proposed to use purely for our own military purposes, which are inconsistent with its habitation by the families of a brave people, end quote, but he also bragged that after his orders were fulfilled, quote, the town will be a real military town with no women boring me at every order I give, end quote. In his mind, a real military town would have no interference from women, especially not enemy women who would constantly nag him by endlessly protesting every move he made and every order he gave. Evictions eliminated this feminine nuisance. In addition, he made it clear that there was no telling what this brave people might do if they remained in Union-occupied Atlanta. Quote, "I will have been a silly fool to take a town at such cost and left it in the occupation of a helpless and hostile people," end quote. He again stressed the dangers of what hostile people might do, especially because they were helpless to respond to the occupying force in a predictable way. In this portrayal, Sherman presented female Confederate civilians as similar to cornered animals, unpredictable, desperate, and thereby dangerous. Quote, "I know the vindictive nature of our enemy, and that we may have many years of military operations from this quarter," end quote. Therefore, he claimed, quote, it is wise and prudent to prepare in time," end quote, "by evacuating the vindictive enemy, regardless of her sex." Paternalism was not just the shared language of men. White women across the South used the language of paternalism to express their outrage against Sherman's orders. For these women, the language and logic of paternalism made the banishment from Atlanta into evictions and violations, rather than evacuations and acts of charity. In their eyes, Sherman, quote, "promulgated an order so infamous that a Russian example must be sought if we would find a parallel amongst civilized nations," end quote. One woman in Ravenswood, Georgia, considered it, quote, "dreadful for women and children to be turned out of doors, homeless," end quote. And she saw the expulsion as particularly harsh because it occurred at the start of winter. She stressed that in the, quote, "darkened annals of history," end quote, "there were no others who, like the Union," quote, "waged war upon helpless women and children," end quote. Like many others, she used the paternalistic language of helpless women to emphasize the inhumanity of the tactic. North Carolinian Catherine Edmonston was similarly repulsed that Sherman, quote, "finds it for the interests of the U.S. that every inhabitant should be banished from Atlanta and its vicinity," end quote. In her mind, there was only one result. What can he expect but resistance to the death from every Southern man, woman, and child in the future, end quote. Whereas Sherman tried to make it seem like clearing Atlanta of its female civilians was for the civilians' own good, women around the Confederacy saw the situation quite differently. Sherman, however, was not bothered by these characterizations of him and his military orders. Although he publicly insisted that he acted with charity, he also proclaimed that the decision was just. Even before the complaints, Sherman rejected the idea that Confederate women deserved protection. In a letter to Halleck, days before he issued Special Field Order 67, he contemplated its reception. Quote, If the people raise a howl against my barbarity and cruelty, I will answer that war is war and not popularity seeking. If they want peace, they and their relations must stop war." End quote. For Sherman, women's role in the Confederate war effort justified their eviction, and the responsibility for their protection belonged to Confederate men. As a result, Sherman ignored their pleas for clemency, throwing their own active role in supporting and supplying soldiers back in their faces. Quote, "Now that war comes to you, you deprecate its horrors, but did not feel them when you sent carloads of soldiers and ammunition and molded shells and shot to carry war into other places." Sherman's response to complaints clearly highlighted his belief in taking retribution on the female enemy. Quote, "War is cruelty, and you cannot refine it. And those who brought war on the country deserve all the curses and maledictions that people can pour out." Sherman's eviction of Atlanta civilians reflected a larger desire to punish Confederate women in the Union's rank and file. Like their commander, many Union soldiers believed that Confederate women had brought these consequences upon themselves. For example, J. Dexter Cotton acknowledged that, quote, "It seems very hard." But he justified the necessity of such actions. He proclaimed that it, quote, "serves them right, for most of the women of the South are generally stronger secessionists than the men." Another soldier urged his family to, quote, "read Sherman's letters to Hood in reference to the removal of the women and children of Atlanta, because they are so good, just the sentiments of his whole army. Such a general, one that is not afraid to treat with them as they deserve, is the man we like to fight under," end quote. These and other Union soldiers relished the fact that Confederate women were finally getting what they deserved. Even Union clergy rejected the idea that Confederate women deserved protection. Reverend George S. Bradley, who traveled with Sherman's troop, ridiculed the notion that soldiers should treat Confederate civilians with charity. He saw mercy as something that Confederate women did not deserve. Quote, "So far as the women are concerned, we might as well spare our pity, for they are the worst secessionists, and why should they not suffer?" End quote. He further wanted these civilians to feel the consequences of their actions. Quote, "Let them understand that secession means something more than a holiday parade." Bradley's attitudes showed not only a lack of empathy for Southern civilians, but also a paternal outlook that dismissed white women as frivolous girls who reduced war to nothing more than a holiday parade. Many Union civilians similarly supported the eviction of white women from Atlanta and dismissed the notion that occupying forces should protect enemy civilians from the hard hand of war. From the safety of the Union home front, Sherman's wife expressed her delight in her husband's actions. Quote, "I'm charmed with your order expelling the inhabitants of Atlanta, as it has always seemed to me preposterous to have our government feeding so many of their people," end quote. Furthermore, she decried the Confederacy's, quote, "insolent women, particularly for they are responsible for the war and should be made to feel that it exists in sternest reality," end quote. Many Union women shared Ellen Sherman's perspective and applauded the harsh treatment of their Confederate counterparts as valid wartime tactic and a necessary step in ending the war. The decision to evict Confederate women resulted from more than just an individual desire for vengeance. Rather than seeing it as an unfortunate necessity, Sherman pursued eviction as a central part of his strategy to, quote, "utterly negate Davis's boasted threat and promises of protection," end quote. In Atlanta, Sherman put into action the lessons he learned in Florida's Seminole Wars and during his tenure as Memphis's wartime governor. War and hostility did not confine themselves to armies. As he noted in 1862, quote, "all the South is in arms and deep in enmity." As a result, by 1864, he wanted to bring war to all the South, regardless of age or sex. Furthermore, Sherman acknowledged white Southern women's dedication to the Confederacy and their involvement in the war effort, explaining to his brother early in the conflict that, quote, "the entire South, man, woman, and child, are against us, armed and determined," end quote. In this light, Sherman's eviction of white Southern women from Atlanta was no accident. Quote, "I want peace and believe it can now only be reached through union and war, and I will ever conduct war with a view to perfect and early success," end quote. In conclusion, Special Field Order 67 is best understood as an eviction of female rebels rather than as an evacuation of helpless civilians. Unwilling to leave women outside the boundaries of warfare and acknowledging their place in the Confederate war effort, Sherman pursued a campaign that used gender ideas to undermine his female enemies instead of protect them. He similarly used gendered language to justify and explain a military policy that treated women as its intended targets. He recognized the vital role that elite women continually played in sustaining Confederate soldiers on the battlefield, and he vowed to strike at the geographic and metaphoric heart of the Confederacy. In bringing war home to female civilians, Sherman and his soldiers hoped to destroy Confederate support and to bring about a rapid end to the war. At the time, the fates of the white women were the focus of the grievances expressed by Confederates about the injustice of the policy, and the presence of the women were similarly at the heart of most Union explanations for the wartime policy. Emphasizing this event as an eviction highlights its original intent, as well as its role in the hard hand of war. Thank you.
And last, but certainly not least, we have Leslie Gordon, who will comment today on this panel, who received her PhD from the University of Georgia. She is professor of history at the University of Akron. She is also author of many books. She told me she didn't want me to tell you the titles of all of her books because she wants you to be sure to pay attention to the one that's just come out. But I think that we should go through her books, which include General George E. Pickett in Life and Legend, Intimate Strategies of the Civil War, Military Commanders and Their Wives, Inside the Confederate Nation, Essays in Honor of Emory M. Thomas, The Terrible War, The Civil War and Its Aftermath, and most recently, I'm going to read this twice for Leslie, so you won't forget, Broken Regiment, The 16th Connecticut Civil War, published by Louisiana State University just this season. You can get it almost anywhere. Right, Leslie? Right. Okay. Take it away, Leslie.
Thank you. Yeah, many of you know that book took me a really long time, so I apologize for my insistence. I was actually carrying that book around for the first week that I got it, so I didn't bring it here. I know. I'm seriously. I'm pleased to comment on this panel. I just have a few comments that I prepared, and we'll have some time for your questions. D.H. Dilbeck opens his paper by asking a series of questions. If you remember, I'm going to repeat a couple of them because I found them so provocative, frankly. Quote, is it possible to wage a just war that directly targets a civilian population? Do warring nations have a moral obligation to contain to the battlefield all the horrors and hardships of warfare? Or can a nation justly directly unleash the terrors of the hard hand of war against noncombatants? For that matter, what exactly would a just war against civilians actually look like in practice? He further asks, what did Lever's Code say about what constituted just warfare against civilians? Underlying these questions is an assumption that there is and was, it seems to me, morality in warfare. Certainly Francis Lieber believed there was. The German-born legal scholar who authored the famed code thought a just war, which is what the Union War was to Lieber, had, in the words of John Fabian Witt in his book Lincoln's Code, had great moral significance. And beyond Lieber's conviction that war could be moral was that saving the country was, quote, paramount to all other considerations. And as we've heard a couple times today, right, he believed in this sharp war, which I love that phrase. I just think that's so fascinating, sharp war, and this war, the sharp war fought vigorously, and that would be better for humanity. Dilbeck contends that Lieber had clear, rather than hazy, as Mark Grimsley seems to suggest, definitions and notions of what this just war on civilians would and could be, hoping that, quote, federal armies abiding his code would best fulfill their obligations to God and humanity as moral beings engaged in war. Lieber may have been less hazy and more concrete in his views on waging or not waging war on certain disloyal civilians, but the examples that David Hopkins presents to us today show that these definitions easily broke down when put into practice. Hopkins reminds us that in places like Missouri and Arkansas, the Civil War evolved easily into mini wars, where notions of rules and conduct appear irrelevant. General Thomas Ewing's General Order No. 11, described by Michael Fellman as, quote, the most drastic measure taken against civilians during the Civil War prior to General Sherman's march to the sea, hardly seemed just or moral to those displaced. And although Lieber sought to identify those, quote, manifestly loyal citizens, those are Lieber's words, such labels meant little or anything when the policy became brutal reality to those affected. The thousands of displaced people included, as Hopkins tells us, were both loyal and disloyal. There was no distinction made, as Lieber would have directed, to ensure that disloyal residents be treated differently. Ewing needed everyone gone. The hardship was shared by all, and the repercussions were clearly severe. Hopkins explains that, in fact, the result, quote, created many enemies of the Federals as a result, sending many of these citizens impacted by the order into the arms of guerrilla fighters in the area. This military order issued by officials like Ewing seeking control, order, in fact, wrested control from these individual civilians, forcing them from their homes. It was, it seems, militarily effective. Yet there's something powerful, too, in the fact that we don't even know the depth or the effects of these orders, because as Hopkins mentions in a footnote, he didn't say, but there aren't any written accounts, apparently, that we know more from archaeological digs, which I find quite telling. Ewing's brother-in-law and foster brother, of course, the Sherman family, quite fascinating, William Ewing, ordered the more famous evacuation of Atlanta nearly a year later. Lisa Frank notes the outrage and anger expressed by Atlanta civilians at Sherman's order. Somehow, quote, he had violated both the unstated and stated rules of war when he evicted Confederate civilians from their homes. Frank recognizes the use and power of language, preferring eviction rather than evacuate, adopting the term paternalistic logic. I love that too, paternalistic logic. Explaining Sherman's reason for forcing women, particularly, and I assume that, you know, you're talking a lot, I assume drawing on Drew Faust's notion of these elite white women, but of course these are all residents, right? So we have all ranges of class and even race, of course, affected. Sherman was more careful than Ewing, it seems, in his order, very much aware of who his order targeted, yet the results were the same, and it seems neither violated Lieber's code. I was asking David last night if, and you can talk here for the audience, how aware Ewing was of Lieber's code, and it, I'm not, and you sort of indirectly make reference to this too, Lisa, you know, what, it doesn't seem to matter to me whether they were aware of Lieber's code. I guess that's my point, and I'd like you to maybe address that, D.H. I mean, why should we care about Lieber's code, right? I mean, we can study it, we can talk about it, it's very interesting in the abstract, it seems to me, but this is the real life experiences that people had. Whether Sherman or Ewing were consciously aware of Lieber's code or concerned with any other sense of policy or restraint, and it seems both were in different contexts, they shared a conviction the war had to be won by any means necessary. So in that sense, they have a lot in common, certainly with Lieber, a sentiment that defined Lieber's code. According to Lieber, the Civil War was just, a moral war to save the Union, and of course, end slavery. In both Missouri and Georgia, the action described here helped to sharpen the war and bring the conflict to, well, I guess it's all relative, a swifter, more decisive end. In the case of Missouri, most agreed both then and now that Ewing's order did dissipate guerrilla activity. Sherman's evacuation of Atlanta was a devastating blow to the Confederate war effort. Sherman, Ewing, Lieber wholeheartedly believed that they were fighting a just war, but so too did their enemies. And I think we can even talk, you know, some of the folks here that, of course, work on these guerrillas, they had a sense of justice and morality themselves that was very, very strong, and it certainly didn't match the notion of justice and morality expressed by people like Sherman and Lieber and Ewing. But I also think perhaps in this other point raised both by Megan and then by Bob Hutton about first this idea that we think about violence in a more expansive way, that I think the examples talked about here, away from the conventional battlefield, we see we can have policy. Sure, we can have policy expressed by somebody like Lieber and the ideals and visions of these military and political leaders, but then we have the actual experience of people impacted directly. Again, whether it's clear that they were, these commanders were acting out on the, acting directly in relation to the code or not. And also, Bob Hutton's point just a little bit ago, that of the long Civil War, right, that I know Aaron's talked about too, the long Civil War, that, that the experiences of these people displaced, whether it's Atlanta or Missouri, it's not over. I mean, Lieber wants a short, sharp war. He wants the war over. Close the book. You have your code. But these experiences have repercussions that continue for generations. And those of you that work on memory know this very well. So I think this, this gives us lots to move forward on in thinking about the repercussions of the war, and certainly opens up our minds to new ways of considering the legacy of the war. So those are my, those are mainly my comments and things that I was thinking about. But let's see if any of you have some questions. Yes.
Well, I have one that would kind of turn your question around. Just not so much were Ewing and Sherman aware of Lieber's code, but was Lieber ever aware of actions by the Union Army where he would criticize them or say, you crossed the line here?
There were maybe one of the most pointed instances of that occurs concerning retaliation against Confederate prisoners, the famous, infamous debate in the U.S. Senate in early 1865 about sort of explicit retaliation in kind to be instituted as policy, very extreme retaliation in kind against Confederate prisoners. In the end, the proposal sort of fizzled out. That don't result in much that's meaningful. But Lieber, very publicly, in editorials, and in fact, his editorials are quoted by Sumner, I believe, on the Senate floor, says, in effect, this proposed retaliation is the retaliation kind is directly contrary to what I set forth in the code. So he is very much conscious of what's being done, what's being proposed, and the extent to which it is or is not living up to what he set forth in the code.
But he would have agreed with Union and Sherman that these evacuation or eviction orders were just.
Well, I think what's...
I guess my point is we've had quite a bit of scholarship on Lieber's code.
Yeah.
So, but we don't know very much at all. We're just starting to learn now about these kind of stories. So I guess I'm wondering, what more do we need to learn about Lieber's code at this point and in conjunction with what we're learning? I guess that's a better way of phrasing it.
An important question that sort of, I think, reveals or gets at what's really important to a large degree about Lieber's code. To me, the interesting question is not so much, did Sherman have a copy of Lieber's code with him at all times, or was he constantly referring to it during March or anywhere? What's more interesting, revealing, important, I think, is exactly what your paper revealed, which is the degree to which, whether or not he's read the code or not, I think he probably has as well, that Sherman seems to be completely in lockstep with the vision of just warfare that Lieber sets forth in the code.
Right.
So I think what that reveals about Lieber's code that's most important is that to some fundamentally important degree, Lieber is articulating a certain set of shared ideas that a lot of Union officers, military commanders are also hold on to, are shaping the way they act.
Yeah, go on.
Of warfare that Americans were well aware of. So despite the rhetoric of these women that in the annals kinds of warfare. There's been nothing like this. You know, sieges in particular, in the medieval period, if you don't surrender, the army gets to kill everyone when they get in to punish you for not surrendering. And it's understood, even when they try to make war more limited, that sieges, you can starve the population. So was there any sense in what you're reading in these documents of kind of placing this eviction in the context of how war was practiced before?
Not in that context, but the women are very aware that this is not unusual. They're just mad. So, and I think they're trying to use a language to sort of tug on people's heartstrings and, you know, to be like, we're so helpless. They're not helpless women. They've been doing things the entire time to help with the war. Some of them, you know, people and women dress up like soldiers. They can help them to help the Confederate war. And then suddenly they're going to play helpless, like, oh, no, we didn't do anything. You can't kick us out. But it's not something that should have been unexpected. They're just trying, I think, they're wanting to think that they're outside of this realm of war, and they're going over with, like, 19th century ideas about the household from antebellum times, and, you know, they're protected, and men will take, you know, make sure that they're in a special realm. And then this comes along. Now they can still try and make the Union seem more like they're totally a separate nation. These people are different. You know, you find all these women calling Yankees are a different race. They're not like us anymore. We never want to be part, you know, of the Union again, because look at these horrible things they've done to us. And then they'll say, well, we wish our men would do that. Oh, no, we wouldn't. Our men are gentlemen, and they would never do that to Northern women. So I think, like, they know some of the history, but they don't. That doesn't get you sympathy, right? They want some sympathy for this. They want people to know that they feel like they're being treated badly, and they don't
want to
go.
And just very quickly, I'll read a quote from Lieber that I think answers your question. I cut this out of paper for the sake of time, but he said at the beginning of the Civil War, the gigantic wars of modern times are less destructive than were the former protracted ones. Sort of the opposite sense of the historical arc of warfare that we have, you know, as we progressed sort of the age of modern total wars, and they're more destructive, more gigantic.
But my understanding of Lieber, too, and I take a lot of this from Witt's book, is that he viewed war, and this is not unusual, right, amongst a lot of these 19th century intellectuals, which is what he was, is that war was a moral endeavor, right? Correct?
Yeah, and morally invigorating.
Yeah. Yeah, and I appreciate that reminder that maybe, you know, we need to appreciate that that's where he was coming from in his vision. And I agree with you that a lot of these commanders, that's they would align with that. That's okay. You know, we need that. But again, we need to go down deep to, again, that grass level to appreciate that that's not necessarily a core, that, you know, the what's going on in these places like Missouri and even in Atlanta, that doesn't make necessarily sense to them, right? Or that's clashing with their own moral code. They have their own moral code that's completely different. And that's important, too, of course, when we think ahead into the post-war in trying to reconstruct this country and figure out what the war was about and what it meant. That's where I think it's really interesting to pursue. Somebody had a question right here in the front.
It's more of a comment, really, and it's coming at you from a philosophical point of view. Once I have defeated you, how much more punishment is just? And that's where I get left with Sherman, is, okay, it's a little over the top here. Because by September of 1864, the war is pretty much over. But it's the
end of the
Good, Leanne.
Leslie, I really like your observation that while this may have been, in military terms, a make for a shorter and sharper war, it makes for a longer cultural war.
Yeah,
afterwards.
Well put. Yeah.
And it's war of a different means. And I think that I would be interested to know what Lisa in particular would think about this. It seems to me that the post-war period is when, in fact, women can fight. So, you know, it's like Sherman's got them by the neck. Mm-hmm. And he can fight this sharp military war and kick them out.
Yeah.
And then we can have a long, long war afterwards where they get their pound of flesh many times
well put.
Over. So depending on how you frame what war is. I mean, if you only want to frame it in military terms, but of course I think, you know, war is just politics by another meaning.
Isn't this what, you know, I'm going to actually say something I'm shocked at. I was thinking about Foucault. I know. I was thinking a lot about, I know. No, I'm sorry. I was surprised that Lieber was involved in the Encyclopedia Britannica, because it struck me that somebody that's so interested in the production of knowledge and the ordering of knowledge, which it seems to me that's part of it, right? And the conformity of knowledge. I thought, wow, that's amazing. And here he is trying to produce this code of behavior. So all this came back to me from graduate school, and I had no idea. This was sort of some fleeting thoughts, clearly didn't get into here, but I think you're absolutely right that it's about, obviously it's about power, these power structure and dynamics. And yes, so I think when you get into the post-war and then the weapons change, And that's why I think it's so interesting what Lisa talks about with language, paying attention to the words that are used, because that's what a lot of it is, right? In defining who is, and he tries to talk about this with guerrillas, and who's an acceptable, right? He tries to sort out, and even who's loyal. I mean, the words he uses, they're really interesting, and this is somebody he's not a native English speaker, so he's clearly, in my mind, I would say, I don't know, but he's selecting his language very, very carefully. So that's, I thought that was a...
And I don't even think you have to go to the post-war era to look at how this makes it a more difficult cultural. I mean, these women who experienced Sherman in Atlanta and then along the march are pushing to continue the war as the soldiers are coming home and surrendering. If the soldiers are defeated, but the women are just, they're pissed off. They can't believe someone went...
Yeah, Aaron?
David, I wonder if you can talk about the public response to General Order No. 11 among other unionists and Confederate civilians in Missouri. I mean, sort of, you know, to connect with this debate, how did the time read that order?
You have many, you know, a few of the records that I found of some unionists, these mountain federals in northwestern Arkansas, sort of thinking aloud that this could happen in Arkansas and other places, and they don't approve it. The few people who at the time do comment on it, but I mean, as I mentioned in my paper, I mean, even Lincoln lets it go. I mean, he doesn't really say he approves of it, but he doesn't, you know, necessarily rescind the order. But the few civilian accounts I've come across, they don't approve of it, and then there are a few, I don't know what newspapers they were in, but a few sort of newspaper editorials.
And do they think it's cruel, or do they think it will be ineffective? I mean, is there any sense of...
No, they come right out and say, look, you're just sort of, yeah, the problem's bad, but you're just making it worse, especially given the fact that you're not differentiating. You're not going through and administering loyalty oaths or asking people, you know, these people could have families who are serving for the Union Army, and you don't know that. And you're sort of really just making the situation worse by just kicking them out. Basically, they can only take what they can carry. And then, of course, you know, Union troops going in to enforce the order are just brutal. Burning down homes, farms, slaughtering livestock. So, yeah, there aren't, at least that I've come across, a lot of positive reviews, so to speak, of Union's order at the time.
I mean, it would be useful to know sort of the extent of whether this is a sanctioned action from the perspective of the public.
Right. No, and the public, you know, they speak ill. You know, especially the biggest one is, Caleb, he does the famous painting, General Order No. 11, that after the war, you know, there's a speech published in like 1866, 1867, where he goes on some 20-page rant.
But this is right, it's equivalent to sort of the women of Atlanta saying, oh, what was me?
I don't think it's
we're
in Louisville,
so I'll take some
foster brother.
Well,
he married his foster sister.
Right,
yeah.
His brother.
We probably should do one more, Michael.
A, a very brief statement, actually, based on what Leanne said, just kind of blew my mind, because I actually get to teach Civil War this semester, and it's a rarity for me, but compare in your minds what George McClellan is thinking, for example, early in the war. Now, you know, we beat their army, the war's over, and we all become friends again, to what your papers are talking about, and how Lieber's Code affects that, how it affects the long war.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, our panel, and thank you, Leslie Gordon, for a wonderful discussion. Let me just ask you to remember that tomorrow morning we begin at 9 o'clock sharp with a keynote address by Aaron Sheehan Dean, entitled Time Will Tell, What Can We Learn About the Civil War from Modern Conflict? So I hope you will join us then. And for all of our presenters, let's give a round of applause. It's been a great day. And if you were a presenter, we will gather for a casual gathering.